both knowing. Crow.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one, episode 648. Jason Lindgren is with me and Mario Garza returns. We're going to be talking about, I guess, simply put, the Wheel of Time, the idea of cycles and these types of things, but maybe not necessarily locked into the Western idea of Pisces and Aquarius or the Eastern idea of the Kali Yuga or the Satya Yuga. But I mean, let's face it, they all relate in some way. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a warm and lovely good afternoon.
All right, you ready to get into this?
Make it so.
All right, Mario, welcome aboard. Why don't you tell folks where they can find you and your works?
For sure. Well, thanks for having me back. It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys. If people are interested in my work, they can go to symbolicstudies.com. And from there, they can check out my Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, all that fun stuff.
All right. Let's just jump right in here. We're talking about cycles of time, but the way that you approach it is maybe less, we kind of approach it in a material way here. Mm-hmm. As you said in the pre-conversation, where we want a date, we want a time, we want a length, we want a measure. So what is your idea about the cycles? Do you think they occur over and over again? Do you think they're unique as they roll forward? What's your take on it?
Yeah, you know, I think in some ways they're definitely unique as they roll forward. It kind of reminds me of that old quote where the patterns basically, they come back around, but what is it? Is it Mark Twain who said something about time rhyming? It's not the exact same thing, but it rhymes. The cycles kind of remind me of that, but the big approach or the general approach that I'll be talking about here is basically the great transition from the last golden age until now and what that looks like for humanity, what that looks like on a spiritual or metaphysical level, and also what that really looks like on a symbolic level. You know, so I'm a symbologist and I look through the symbolic lens essentially with everything that I'm decoding or that I'm researching. And it's really fascinating what some authors have written about with the symbolic difference of the modern mindset, how we view sort of the world versus what people way back when, how they used to view things. And so I am definitely coming from what could be referred to as a traditionalist or a perennialist background. And in my opinion, the traditionalists were some of the best symbologists of the modern world. And you could say that René Guénon is sort of the godfather of the traditionalists. And he has a number of books that are really worth checking out. But the two in particular that I'll be referencing would be The Reign of Quantity from 1945. And then he also has a book called The Crisis of the Modern World from 1927. And so between these two books, he really highlights the major difference of what this early age, this golden age, which can be referred to as the primordial tradition, how people lived, how they viewed things versus where we're at now. And he basically gets through the metaphysics, goes over the metaphysics of the sort of degradation of humanity and sort of the loss of this divine connection. So to me, all of that stuff is really fascinating to consider. So that's going to be the big, big sort of overarching thing we'll be looking at.
So to frame it up, if you're going to talk about a golden age, I think the implication here is that there is a time when you're in a golden age and a time when you're falling away from a golden age.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, do you feel like it's a distance that gets covered and then it happens? Do you think it's more organic? And are we talking about massive lengths of time between, say, one golden age and the next?
Yeah. I would say there's massive lengths of time for sure, like thousands of years. And the way I personally look at it is that it seems as though during this last golden age, people were more grounded, right? People were more centered. People saw things as being divine. Everything was divine. Everything had meaning. There is this, what I say, there was this vertical orientation. So you were in touch symbolically with the heavens. And then basically there has been this gradual shift away from that. There has been this gradual descent away literally from the center. And so this is interesting to me because when we're talking about time, the wheel has come into the picture and has been used as sort of this visual concept related to time, right? So the wheel turns, right? The wheel's always spinning. And so when you're looking at a lot of great age charts and whatnot, you will oftentimes see these great ages laid out in a wheel, right? And then we also have the standard clock face, and it looks kind of like a wheel. and then you have the hands going around that central point of pivot. You also have this idea of the luminaries being associated with chariots, right? So there's the chariot of the sun and Mars and things like that. This has been depicted time and time again. The luminaries are the planets as chariots. And so the chariot can't function without a wheel, right? So we're going back to this sort of circular wheel concept. And so time has always been associated with circles and this looping nature. And when you break down wheel symbolism, it plays into exactly what we're going to be talking about today. So the outside of the wheel, the circumference of the wheel, is related more so to things outside of self. You know, we're kind of all like our own wheel symbolically. The outside of the wheel is related more so to the material world, the physical world. The outside of the wheel is the least balanced part of the wheel because it's always spinning. It's related to division. It's related to multiplicity. It's not unlike a pie chart, right? The pie chart looks just like a wheel, or a pizza looks just like a wheel as well, right? So those different wedges represent these different compartments or these different lines of division. And so the outside of the wheel really has a lot to do with physicality. Now, where you want to be on the internal part of the wheel, symbolically, metaphysically. The inside of the wheel, the axle of the wheel, is where the reconciliation of opposites occurs. It's beyond all oppositions. The axle of the wheel is the transcendental part of the wheel symbolically. And so you could say that the internal part of the wheel, the axle, represents supreme unity. It represents the supreme principle, right? And what's been said is that when you get to the inside of the wheel, symbolically, you become what's referred to as the unmoved mover, or the prime mover, or the motionless mover. There's lots of different names. But you cause the wheel to turn by being stationary, by being immutable, by being at the still point in the center of that wheel. And so sort of the big difference between the golden age and the modern darker age is that people back then, they were actually more centered. They were kind of in the middle of their wheel symbolically. And everything apparently in their culture kind of echoed that. Now we're kind of all operating, most people are operating on the outside of the wheel, which again relates to material things in the physical world. And once again, is the least balanced part of the wheel. And so my opinion was that there are realms above and below, and they're all connected through their center. There's this sort of symbolic bridge or axis that exists between all things at the center. And it kind of reminds me actually of our chakra system. So let's just say we have seven chakras. Chakra basically just means disc or wheel, and they're all connected through their center. So it's the spine, right? The spine would be sort of that symbolic axis. So really, when you're dealing with wheel symbolism, you're dealing with axial symbolism. That axis in the middle of the wheel is the most primary important part of any sort of wheel system. But it's really the center of any system is sort of the heart of that system as well.
Well, when we look at the ideas you've expressed and we look back at a distant time behind us where people were more attuned, I think it illustrates perfectly what social engineering has done. The Vatican being one of the earliest places setting out to control lives. And what do? They separate from nature. And we are very separated from nature. And it occurs to me that to experience something like a golden age, or as you're saying it, to come back to your center, to be more in tune, you in fact have to get away from materialism and synthetic things, and you have to come back to natural things, which are the containers for all truth and the prover of all truth. And if we want to be honest about it, if we're talking about time or the wheel of time, without the sky clock, we don't really have a way to measure that.
When is the last golden age supposed to have occurred?
Right. That's a great question. And to be honest with you, I'm not exactly caught up on the exact dates of things, simply because I don't know what year we're exactly in. And so I feel like anything that is that long ago, it would be pretty much speculation on my part. So I've read a lot of different things over time, but I can't say that I have like a firm sort of confident answer for that one.
Well, in some ways, the answer to that is it depends who you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've referenced Sri Yukteswar's book many times, The Holy Science, the first 12 pages seek to reset the yugas. But this is the problem, because even in the Indian tradition, the claim being made there is that these calculations for their ancient yuga cycle were done when we were in a very dark age, and they messed it up because their consciousness was low. So he's redone it. And if you want to look at the Western idea of the age of Aquarius supposedly being the next in line, go ahead, ask 10 people. You'll probably get 10 different answers. So to be honest, Jason, I don't really think that there is an honest answer other than roundabout millennium or something like that to try to describe it.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting as well because there is a symbolic aspect to the wheel symbolism and the axis or the center point of pivot with the wheel, where that is actually where you are outside of time symbolically. And so it's interesting that there's a lot of people that want to break out of the matrix. And to me, it's almost like if you're going to do it, if you're the closest thing you can do to that is actually breaking in, you know, getting to that still point within. There's a reason why, as an example, Buddha, you can see him meditating in the middle of a wheel, right? Because he is symbolically that axis in the middle of the wheel. So he's kind of operating in a way outside of time. And he's also seen meditating in front of a tree where he gained enlightenment. In my opinion, symbolically, that tree is a representation of that axis. And tree symbolism basically represents the axis. And when you break down just really fundamental axial symbolism, it usually represents bridging the gap between heaven and earth. So the tree represents bridging the gap between heaven and earth. The tower, like the Tower of Babel, represents the same thing. The mountain, the holy mountain, Mount Meru, or the polar mountain, represents essentially the same thing. And in actuality, mankind represents this too. It's really fascinating to me that there's a number of gods that have been associated with the potter's wheel. And I was just looking into some Egyptian stuff recently, and there's a couple of deities in that pantheon that are creation gods, and they're associated with the potter's wheel. And you will actually see them in front of a potter's wheel creating man. And so there'll be a little figure, a person in the middle of that wheel, and they're shaping mankind. They're creating it from this potter's wheel, from clay. And so to me, that shows me, which is something that I've already known, but mankind is also an axis sort of symbol. The number one is also an axis symbol. It's just a straight vertical line. And so when you see things that kind of are emblematic of a pole in the tarot, there's a ton of staffs, right? The hermit is holding a staff. There's a lot of wands. The magician is holding a wand. He's pointing it up to the heavens and he's pointing his other hand down to the ground. He's basically saying, I connect heaven and earth. I am the bridge between heaven and earth. And I also separate heaven and earth. And that card corresponds with the number one. So again, the one represents sort of that supreme unity in the center of the wheel, in my opinion. And in actuality, all leaders represent this axis as well. We did a show a couple years ago on the pole star. That was actually episode 549. And a lot of that information weaves into what I'm saying here pretty well as well, because it's my understanding that a lot of kings and emperors and lords, especially in the East, they actually identified themselves with the pole star. And so you'll find a lot of Eastern examples of different leaders embodying the pole star and actually putting it in their texts and everything else. Well, when you're dealing with the pole star, you're dealing with the center of the wheel of heaven, because all of the fixed stars revolve around this central star.
And not only that, it never sets. For people who have never done sky watching, if you go to Google and you do a search time lapse for the pole star, and you'll see all of the stars streaking around that central point, and it never sets. Mm-hmm. So it truly is a focal point, but it also brings up a lot of other questions. I mean, commonsensically, all the things that we've been told in the modern age, like all the NASA ideas, and as an example, you could consider, if you model out all of the motions NASA gives us for even just our solar system, and then recognize that that pole star, it doesn't move. But then again, you're also told that in another 10,000 years, there will be a different pole star. And I'll be quite frank, I do not accept that idea currently. And no one's going to live long enough to prove it one way or the other. So you basically get to the point where you take it on faith because someone said it was so, or you do the observation. But what's surprising to me, Mario, is that the pole star doesn't gain more interest in the modern era.
Well, exactly right. Yeah. No, you're 100% right. And this is actually one of the big shifts that happened over time between the golden age and the modern world. My understanding is that during the last golden age, the sky clock that people were focused on was actually more so the fixed stars, and specifically the stars right around the pole star, which is Ursa Major and Ursa Minor. And so I've come across a number of different texts that make reference to this, that essentially the earliest primordial sky clock was the northern sky. And so people were focused on Ursa Major going around the pole star. This is very, very different from most people in today's world, where the focus is the sun. And so you can make the case, in my opinion, personally, that there is a relationship between a golden age and sort of this this cosmology that had this emphasis on the center in the northern sky, which a lot of cultures have said is the stairway to heaven or the seat of God. There's all sorts of mythical and mystical things associated with the northern sky. And that kind of having a relationship with geocentrism as well versus today's world, where the sun is the emphasis, the sun is the focus, and the signs of astrology, you know, the path of the sun, the ecliptic, you know, that's what people are paying attention to. So when you focus on the pole star, there's a whole entire sort of spiritual metaphysical framework that comes with it, because you're emphasizing the center, you know, of the heavens. And even the rotation of the fixed stars, from our perspective, they go counterclockwise. And I've looked into the counterclockwise rotation versus the clockwise rotation. And seemingly, the clockwise rotation is very expansive. So it actually moves and drifts symbolically away from the center. And the counterclockwise rotation actually is more contractive. So it actually brings you closer to the center. And so this all has to do with orientation as well. The pole star was the point of orientation for early seafarers. If you knew where the North Star was, you knew where you were going. And so there's a reason why we have expressions like true north, right? Following your true north. To me, this is following your true authenticity, right? Or the pole star being referred to as the guiding star, right? It kind of guides. So the real point of orientation is the center. And this is why these leaders identified with the pole star, because they wanted to be the point of orientation for their people and for their empire.
We're far away from these ideas now because of GPS and things like this. I know people who are my age, grew up in the city they're in, and they get lost without their GPS. And this is a good example of what we're talking about. To get back to a golden age, we have to get back to nature. And the idea of using GPS to get around is a good example of this, because what's happened is they've lost their spatial mindset. You know, their spatial recognition of the city they live in has been diminished because this little screen will tell you make a left. So what it does in your way of thinking on the macro, like what we're talking about, but in that car in the micro, the brain is no longer mapping out in its mind a 3D city and placing and plotting a course. It's just simply saying, when do I go left? When do I go right? And this is a good example of what we're talking about. And I noticed when you said the fixed stars, your usage of fixed stars, you're simply referring to the stars that don't set, right?
I'm referring to the fixed stars. So all of the stars that you see in the sky, with exception to the wandering stars, the planets.
So you're referring to all the stars when you say fixed stars?
Yes.
Okay. And I was going to make that point, because if you do go out and look at the North Star, first of all, it's very dim. People are usually surprised at how dim it is. But the constellations immediately around it, there are stars there that never set, which Mario has mentioned. And if you consider having an actual sky clock, well, then that pole star becomes the center where the hands dial out. And most people are familiar with the Big Dipper. That's actually the Bear constellation that Mario was talking about. And it is literally a clock, except it's not going clockwise, as you mentioned. I guess the way you explained it, you could imagine a spiral. And if you're spiraling counterclockwise, your hand gets wider and wider in the spiral. If you're going clockwise, it gets tighter and tighter. And that also matches, like, some things Fortune taught me in meditation, to use that spiral to either connect or disconnect.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So to me, it's really fascinating, as an example, when you start looking into symbolism associated with Islam, everyone, it's their duty to go to Mecca at some point and visit the Kaaba cube. The Kaaba cube is a central axis symbol, essentially. So no matter where you're at in the world, that's their spiritual pole. So that's what they consider to be the center of the world or the navel of the world, right? And so most cultures that have sort of a framework intact, like a religious framework, generally they have something that kind of represents their spiritual pole. So for some people, you know, it would be the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. For Muslims, it's Mecca. And so when you go to Mecca, you go around the Kaaba cube 7 times and you're going around it counterclockwise. And so there is kind of this dynamic of drifting towards the center when you're going around counterclockwise. And the number 7 is super interesting as well, because Ursa Major has 7 stars. And I'm kind of convinced, actually, that we get the shape of the number 7 from Ursa Major. That's actually how you locate, or how a lot of people have located, the North Star. You look at the Big Dipper, and when you look at the vessel portion of the Big Dipper, it actually points, those 2 stars at the very end point towards the North Star. So it almost kind of makes like a number 7, basically. But yeah, so all of this stuff I found to be very, very interesting over the years. So I think that nowadays, people, with not paying attention to these older sort of ideas or frameworks or whatever, essentially we've drifted away from that central pole, both kind of on a symbolic level in the heavens, but then also kind of internally and spiritually and everything else.
Which I think you could prove by simply going out and seeing people on the street at night and saying, can you please point at the North Star? How many right. of them would be willing to do it? And what you just told people is very valuable. Most people can locate the Big Dipper. And you should keep in mind, sometimes it's upside down. Sometimes it rotates around that central point. But if you go down to the cup portion of the Big Dipper, there are 4 stars that make the cup. The outer top one and the outer bottom one make a line. If you take your thumb and your pinky and spread them apart like the Hawaiian symbol, and you put it on the top one and draw a line through those stars, your pinky will land roughly, depending on size of your hand, 20, 25 degrees away, will point exactly to the pole star, which will help you find it. You can look it up online, and it's a very good thing to know. Most of us will never be lost, but if you ever are and you can find the pole star, it could save your life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Yeah, so this kind of weaves in very nicely as well with some of what I want to say regarding just the symbolism of the Golden Age, which is my second bullet point here. And it's interesting that all compasses point where? They point north, right? To the North Pole. And it's fascinating to me that a lot of people have suggested that the North Pole is the sort of symbolic center of Earth. And there's a lot to be said about paradise, or this early time of utopia, the primordial origins of man kind of having this relationship with the North Pole. And so this has kind of been echoed in a lot of different cultural frameworks, but this is where a lot of people have suggested is, you know, there's Mount Meru, or it would be known in some cultures as like the Holy Mountain or the Polar Mountain. The lodestone would be another thing. People have this mythical idea that there's a magnetic stone at the north. And actually, the North Star has been referred to as the lodestar as well. So there's this natural relationship between the North Pole and the pole star, because we're talking about that central axis, right? Which has been referred to as the world axis or the axis mundi. And my understanding is that in primordial Golden Age times, that this central axis was of supreme importance because it was the spiritual axis and it connected the realms above and below. And so this would be the point of pivot basically for all things. And so there's actually just a northern correspondence with the idea of the center as well.
Well, when you referred to the lode as the descriptive word, to me that implies magnetism, but mm-hmm. I think a lot of people don't realize how compasses work. There's true north and then there's magnetic north.
Right.
And when you grab a compass, your compass is not pointing to true north. It's pointing to magnetic north. True north would be if it pointed directly at the so-called North Pole. And what actually happens, and this is funny too, when I was young and my father taught me about this because we used compasses on sailboats, he said that the needle points to an iron lode up in Michigan. Well, they don't say that anymore. And they did used to say that when I was young. They say it's the Earth's magnetic field is the way they describe it, and it changes. But when I got my first telescope, to align it, you have to put it on the pole star and you have to do this alignment to get the scope to track the sky perfectly. And this is where I learned that magnetic north is not true north. And what happens is you take your compass and it points to magnetic north. Then depending on your geography, you do a known calculation to bring you back to true north, where the scope needs to actually be fixed and aligned to. And I think these are important things for people to know, because truly, if we are headed back towards a golden age, we have to get back to nature, where truth is truth.
Right, right. And you're absolutely right with that. I was looking into it years ago, but the military, I think, has like three or four different definitions of what North is. And you have to sort of translate the information. So if you're using one kind of map and one sort of compass, you have to know what you're doing in order to really use that information like viably. And that there's like several definitions of what this North sort of concept actually represents. So yeah, the way I'm phrasing it definitely is more of a general sort of thing, but absolutely there are nuances there.
You know, back in the day when I got that first scope and we actually got a small booklet that showed how everything worked, I love those days. I miss those days. I'm not thrilled with the whole PDF thing, to say the least, but in that booklet, there was a map of the United States with magnetic lines so that it would tell you how many degrees you offset. And I was in San Diego. So if I remember, I don't remember, but it was just a few degrees offset. And this map showed you for the entire country what you had to offset your compass to get to true north. And this is another good reason to be able to locate the North Star, because if you can locate that, you don't have to do any calculation to know that you're headed north.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah. So to me, this idea of the North having this kind of paradise concept related to it, or having this mountain sort of dynamic associated with it, it's always said too that the North has, this is where the four winds sort of emanate from. You could also interpret that as sort of like a symbolic cross. And so wind that symbolically goes north, south, east, and west, but then the North would kind of be right at the middle of this cross, which would sort of symbolically be in the middle of this crossroad. Also, people basically, what they do is they have this idea that this is where heaven and earth meets. That's sort of the primordial origin of that concept, in my opinion. And so it has to do with this world axis dynamic, this pole that extends from the North Pole to the Pole Star. So what seems to be the case is that people have taken this original framework of this bridge between heaven and earth existing at the North. And now whenever anyone, any culture, any group, when they have a sort of holy land, a sort of sacred center for their people, it's actually echoing this original framework. It's echoing this original sort of blueprint of this northern sort of concept, this northern dynamic. So again, in Mecca, it's the same exact thing. This is their pole, their symbolic pole. And there's symbolic poles all over the place. And this is what a lot of holy mountains represent too. And so there's different holy mountains where people will do the exact same ritual you see in Mecca with their holy mountains. So Mount Kailash comes to mind. There's a lot of Buddhists that will go to this mountain, and every handful of years, they circumambulate it. They revolve around it. And what's actually fascinating is I was watching a documentary recently, and the newer Buddhists, they will go around the mountain clockwise, which is more of a solar rotation, by the way. So you could say a clockwise rotation is more solar. That's exactly like our standard clock face. Or the counterclockwise rotation is actually more polar. You're getting closer to that center. And so the newer Buddhists, it was the vast majority of them, by the way, it was like 90%, 95% of everybody goes around this mountain clockwise. But the older Buddhists who kind of have this more primordial concept of Buddhism, they actually all go counterclockwise around it.
That's interesting. It's not just the Buddhists, by the way. It's all of Hindus and I believe Jains. I think there's more than that. But I mean, what you're illustrating is how the past generations thought about things being closer to nature. And I wanted to tell you about this. I saw there's a famous cartoonist from the early 1900s. I think his name starts with S. People know who it is, or you could look it up. I've forgotten. But I saw a Humpty Dumpty animation that had been restored by the UC college system in California. And the idea was Humpty Dumpty was greedy. He had a golden wall and he forced everyone to build his golden wall up to the sun. You know why? Because he wanted all the gold of the sun. This is openly being shown to people back then. But here's the thing. When he gets up to the sun, he cracks it open and an electric man comes out and kicks him out. So not only did they still have in their minds the association with gold in the sun in these cycles, but that it wasn't a nuclear furnace. It was clearly electromagnetic. And in the northern things that we're talking about, like 3 weeks ago, people in Rhode Island saw the northern lights. So not only are we calling the North Star and the idea of these mountains, which represent a northern or a central pinnacle, the northern lights are coming more south. And that's to do with magnetism. And I think all these ideas have gotten far away from us. I don't think anyone would make a cartoon like that today and associate electric ideas with the sun or gold, just to make the point about the difference in the separation from nature.
Right, right. Well, that's really fascinating as well, because something that I've come across is, we're talking about this golden age, right? So we're gold, you know, the symbolism of gold, and gold associates with the sun, right? And so all of the planets have this relationship with a different metal. Gold is considered to be, you know, the king of precious metals. And what I've read is that in the golden age, funny enough, that the way they viewed nature, that nature wasn't something to be owned and that it was unownable, that you could not possess nature and own it the way we kind of think you can own it in today's world. And so there's a fascinating chapter, I believe it's in The Reign of Quantity and the Signs of the Times, where Gwenon talks about the degradation of coinage. And he gets into this idea that coins originally had this spiritual dynamic with it, that it was almost like you were carrying a spiritual totem with you, that it wasn't for material purposes. It wasn't for just monetary value. It wasn't for purchasing power, that actually there is a sacred ritualistic aspect to the original coin. And the idea was that way back when, even before that, people had this idea that you cannot own gold, that to own gold is almost like this ridiculous sort of concept. And it's almost like trying to own part of the sun, that it's unownable. And so that there is such a sacred sort of value put onto it, that that wasn't something that you can do. And it only became over time, when people drifted away from the center, had this symbolic fall from grace, this descent, did people start changing their concept about these metals, and especially gold. So now we have people and cultures and kings and things like that hoarding gold and wanting to own and possess as much as possible. But they had a very different sort of idea way back when about that.
Well, they were closer to nature. So let's make the point about gold, which most people never consider. Why is gold special? Most people think because it's valuable. But here's the thing. Alchemy teaches us, or used to teach us, that each metal can be transmuted into gold, but it has to go in the proper line through the metals, the last one always being silver. At least that's one of the prominent ideas that used to get expressed. But what's special about gold? Many old cultures called the blood of the sun gold, but gold is special because it is unique in all the world. And why can't somebody own it? How can somebody own a thing that is outside of time? We're going to be lucky if we get 80 years. Gold doesn't recognize time. It is the only thing that I am aware of in this duality world that we live in that doesn't diminish, rust, disintegrate, change. It is literally outside of time. Gold today, if I set it in the ocean or on a mountaintop, will still be gold in 1,000 millennia. And that is why gold is special. But how do we forget the idea of each metal being able to transmute towards that purity? And that is also why gold is always the, to make the pun, gold standard for the idea of enlightenment. Because when a human spiritual path reaches that, then you too are outside of time and become unchanging.
There you go. Beautiful. Really well put. Excellent points. And, you know, this is kind of reminding me too, just with time itself, how do most people spend their time in today's world, in the modern world? Well, a lot of people have to spend time working, right, to symbolically acquire their gold so that they can make ends meet and everything else. And this was another distinction of the golden age, based on my understanding of things, is that everything literally had meaning and purpose. Everything had an intention. So what you were wearing, There was a ritual aspect to what you were wearing. You weren't just wearing something because it's the new fashion or whatever. You weren't just saying anything as well because it's the new sort of word of the day or what have you. Everything was traditional. So we're dealing with really traditionalism and traditional societies that had traditions intact. And so they had specific holy days that encoded lots of interesting sort of truths, metaphysical truths, and everything in their life had this sort of sacred aspect, including what we call work, which they did not have that word. It wasn't viewed as work. And so the idea was you were here for a reason. You were put here on this planet to do something. And they believed that if you followed your sort of true path, that you would embrace and embody whatever occupation it might be. So if you were a baker, this is what you were here to do. You maybe came from a line of bakers, or if you're a farmer or whatever it was, a blacksmith. But the thing was that back then, my understanding is that when you had this sort of role, regardless of what it was, there was actually such a sacred dynamic with it that essentially you were part of a priesthood. So you were part of a priesthood of blacksmiths or masons, right? Or bakers. And so even in your work, there was sort of a metaphysical aspect to all of that. In today's world, we've completely lost that, right? And so I just recently heard a term called a shadow career. And so most people are kind of fulfilling their shadow career. So yes, it makes ends meet. Yes, you're making money, but it's not really what you're here to do. You know, there's no sort of sacred aspect to it. So everything was just so sacred way back when that literally even your work was part of sort of your spiritual framework, right? And they had a completely different idea of what this sort of is all about, basically. And so as we've had this fall from grace, as we've had this descent, our relationship with work has also changed.
What you just laid down is well represented in a book called The Mystery of the Cathedrals. One of the reasons The Mystery of the Cathedrals was written was to go contrary to the story we're given of how the cathedrals got here. But in the ideas that Mario just expressed, one of the things that we lost to our detriment was guilds.
Yes.
And in a guild, you took an aptitude test when you were young. And what the aptitude, and they still do this in some places like China and others, what it did is it determined not what we think you should be, but what you are truly gravitate towards. Then there was a guild for that. And you went into the guild as an apprentice. Now, this is a million miles away from what we do. We go into a room where we're taught to shut up, sit down, memorize, raise your hand to speak, ask permission to pee. It is completely built around the idea that you will go work for the factory. Back in the guild time, they were creating craftsmen and experts. But further in Mystery of the Cathedrals, they make this claim that the people that built those cathedrals did it on donated time because they loved what they were doing. Work was so different back then that the average person, I forget the exact time, I want to say 12 or 14 weeks, that's how long they had to work to have a better than upper middle class existence. And after they had spent that short amount of time for the year so that they could live and pay for their family and eat and all the things you need to do, they donated their time to make those cathedrals. Further, the cathedrals were not churches. They were spiritual centers, but they were primarily gathering places and healing edifices that were actually functional. Claims are made like, where do we get the name for the pipe organ that was in there? Well, the resonance coming off those carefully tuned organs in that resonance chamber, we call the cathedral main hall, was healing your inner organs. These are some of the claims you hear, but in that book, exactly what you laid down is described by an anonymous writer claiming he is trying to correct the historical narrative because the Catholic Church wants you to believe they built Notre Dame.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. No, once you sort of wrap your head around it, it makes all the sense in the world. And so that's actually one of the things that kind of pains me the most as a modern person thinking about that is how much time people put into their career and their work. And so much of it is really meaningless now, right? And there's a whole aspect too with becoming anonymous and obviously becoming just a cog in the system, becoming just a number. And basically, now we've taken on a really sort of mechanical kind of role. We're becoming more and more machine-like, people are. And so as you're doing the work too, you're just kind of like an automaton essentially these days.
Well, even if you consider the idea of being an apprentice in a guild that literally looks at what they're doing, almost like a religious experience, even if you're a baker or anything else, what would be the outcome of, say, 10 generations in a guild system like that, where an apprentice comes, is taught? Theoretically, human beings get better, right? The Olympics should be an example of this. How come it isn't that the all the records that were made in 1900 were broken? Well, because human beings get better at things, right? And that may not be the best example. But imagine over 10 generations of a guild system with apprentice, the level of craftsmanship that you could expect to see. And this is what we have said goodbye to in the age of materialism. Now we're all used to buying something that we have no idea how or when it was built. And we plan to throw it away before the end of the year and get a new one. And this is part of the descending age that, in my view, and I don't know where you stand on it, I think we have turned the corner and we are no longer descending. What's your point of view on that?
Yeah, you know, I'm not really sure. I can really see the case for both arguments. If someone, like for yourself, if we are kind of ascending and we're swinging out of this dark age, I can see that on a personal level. It does feel that way. But when I look on the world stage and just, you know, when I'm looking out there and seeing how people are acting and everything else, I can also see the case that maybe there's a little bit of a ways to go.
Well, let me try to frame that up. When I look at what you just said, the way I view it is personally and with my spiritual vision, I detect upward motion in consciousness and spirituality. But if I look at the world stage, as you put it, what I see is an artificial reality trying to convince us all that there is no such thing as a golden age.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, that makes sense for sure. So the other thing with this work dynamic too, I love this conversation and what you've put out there with the guilds and everything else, is what I've read from some of these traditionalists is that essentially way back when people had this authentic work, this authentic, sacred, ritualistic kind of work, with what they were creating and what they were doing, people weren't concerned with even receiving credit for it. That wasn't the point. Nowadays, as we've kind of gone through this darker cycle, now people want the credit for it. Now people want, as an example, putting your signature on something. Apparently, that's something that's become more of a modern sort of thing, to have to label something as your own creation versus people way back when. I don't think that was such a concern at all.
Well, I think they recognized back then that they are not their name. If you can still dig up old texts, you will hear people refer to themselves or others as the one. Also, consider the time that we think is quaint now. I wish it would come back when we said thee and thou, because these ways of speaking start to break the idea that I am my name. And unfortunately, the entire system of deception is built right now on convincing you that you are your identification, that you are your name, and that you are that paper somehow, where back then it was crystal clear that I am the one. And that's a big difference. And
exactly.
It takes generations to whip that out of people.
For sure. No, you got it. 100%. So this drift away from center has been referred to as a counter-initiation. And so my understanding with initiation is that it's kind of right there in the name, initiation, right? It starts within, going within, your holy of holies, your sacred center, you identifying with the one. It's also interesting too that even I, it begins with I, right? The letter I, the uppercase I, looks like a one as well. And then also it's a reference to you as in like your identification, I, myself. And so initiation symbolically brings you closer to this center, and you're sort of receiving this transmission. What some people have said is that a real initiatory experience with a real system that has initiated peoples in it, you are basically receiving a transmission from this last golden age. You're receiving the wisdom of this last golden age. Personally, for me, I refer to it as polar wisdom. To me, that makes a lot of sense. So as you're going through the initiatic process, you are getting closer to that holy of holies. Now, counter-initiation is actually the removal of yourself from that center, essentially. And so this is what some traditionalists have referred to it as. And so it's also interesting too, when someone is unhinged, right? Someone's out of touch or they're off balance. These words or these expressions relate back to the center as well. Unhinged. That means that you don't have a point of orientation. You don't have a point of pivot, or being lost at sea. You don't know where the North Star is. You don't know what your orientation is. You don't know sort of where you're at in space. You're all over the place symbolically. And so to me, it's kind of interesting that we just have these natural words that kind of relate to the center. And of course, we have people that are not there. And so they're adrift, right? Or they're unanchored, right? That's another thing with the center as well. There's this anchoring sort of dynamic with it. So a few things related to counter-initiation and sort of where we find ourselves today.
Well, what you're pointing out to me is the incredibly important realities that are attached to language. And it is another thing that has taken a massive hit from the digital realm. And this was by design. We got Twitter. You can write 100 and some characters, not a full idea. You can make a video, but it's a short. We call it a short. And what this has done is skewed in the same way the GPS kills our spatial orientation. And that is a big deal. The decimation of language and attention spans in future generations will cut off to some degree their ability to look at a word as you just did, Mario, and gain all the meaning that was left there for us. As an example of this, when COVID hit, everyone was told, you got to take this shot. It was a mandate. And everyone said, oh my God, a mandate. Yeah, we got to take the shot. It's a mandate. Did anyone ever take the time to look up the word mandate? It is not a you have to, you must word. Far from it. And yet our loss of ability because of how we use screens these days seems to block us from being able to get back to the meanings of things. And Michael Hoffman, in my view, has done the best job in showing how that was done to us. And he refers to us as having been, to use your idea, initiated into the alchemical crucible. And I often post one of his paragraphs. I just put it in a blog because it's the best description I've run into. But we're coming close to the top of the hour here. Jason, I kind of bogarted that. You want to jump in at all?
I think I'm good. Lots of interesting stuff, though.
All right. Well, we're there, Mario. We've got a lot more to get through. Why don't you tell folks one more time where they can find you and your works?
Yeah, absolutely. So symbolicstudies.com is where you can find all my links.
Just as an off question, before I wrap up hour one, prep up for hour two, have you read Mystery of the Cathedrals?
I have not, no, but I am somewhat familiar with it.
If I was you, I would give that a look, as well as the first 12 pages of Sri Yukteswar's Holy Science, if you have any biblical interest, the rest of that book. But let me wrap up here and we'll prep for hour two. In hour two, we're going to get into a lot more that has to do with the cycles, where we are, where we're headed. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for access to everything. They get access to all the comments, the forums. They can create top-level ideas to talk about. They can download my solar still images to print. If you do that, please take an image and send it to us. They can access the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon that has 10 awards in the world covering all my older telescope work. Members get exclusive access to my solar work right now, and I've gotten a lot better over this season with what I'm capturing and how I'm capturing it. Lastly, all new members get to choose a solar still to print. And if you do the free month year thing, you get more than one. Anyhow, we're going to wrap up hour one of 648 and we'll be back shortly. There it is, man. I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. Cheers. We'll be right back.
belief is the enemy of knowing.